Hi Muslims, it's Mo here. Before we dive into this month's episodes, I just want to set the tone a little. These episodes sit close to my heart. We've been talking about culture for a while now. Not the textbook version, but the real thing, you know. The stuff that shapes how we move around the world, how we speak to ourselves, how we love, and how we survive. And this month's stories feel like a continuation of that. You hear from people whose lives stretch across continents and languages, people who have built careers caring for children, navigating global systems, or helping others untangle the wounds they grew up pretending didn't hurt. You hear reflections on what it means to grow up in cultures that don't always give room for softness and what it looks like to reclaim that softness as adults. You hear about identity, belonging, and the quiet courage it takes to heal old wounds, especially the ones passed down to us. And somewhere in the middle of all of that, you will get a small window into my own life and career, the friendships that have helped me for almost a decade, the cross-cultural lessons I'm still learning, and the everyday ways I'm still becoming. So take a breath with me, settle in. This month is tender, layered, and very human. Now, let's get into the episode.
I guess, I don't know. I mean, we can talk about this afterwards
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
I'm just a very curious person. Like, I wonder what motivated you to start this podcast, because it's a lot of work.
And I'm a very busy person.
That's only one question. So the second question is like how you're doing as a Fulbrighter in Korea.
Okay. I feel like you should just host the. Let me send you the questions so you can host the podcast. I love this. I hardly have guests like turning around like in the beginning phase. Okay, why do I do the podcast? So I'm Nigerian born. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Nigeria. I moved to the U.S. 14 years ago for grad school, mm-hmm. and I just stayed back. Mm-hmm. And growing up as a kid, I was always curious. As a matter of fact, I got into trouble a lot because I'll ask questions nobody was asking. And I'm like, why is that way? And they'll be like, oh, I don't know if you know a lot about cultural dynamics in Nigeria, but being mm-hmm. female and just being, you're supposed to be demure. You're supposed to be, you know, you should be seen and not heard, you know? Mm-hmm. But I was so different. I would ask questions, I'd get into trouble. Mm-hmm. And so, but I read a lot. I was also an avid reader, like mm-hmm. cultural explorations, reading encyclopedias was one of my favorite things as a kid. Mm-hmm. And I went to a good primary school that had a robust library. And then during break, I would just go there, plump, you know, into the chair and then just read encyclopedias about mm-hmm. cultures around the world and in books. So coming to the US was almost like living out some of the head knowledge I had about people and lived experiences.
Yeah.
And I'm always fascinated by our differences, not as a way to, you know, come off in an ethnocentric way, like my culture is better, but no, mm-hmm. I want to explore those differences and just say, okay, you're different from me. That's fine. But okay. Mm-hmm. That said, you love rice. Oh, I love rice too. We can talk about rice more. Yeah. and then in grad school, just having conversations I went to Austin, UT Austin, and it was such mm-hmm. a hodgepodge of cultures. And the more I kept talking to people, the more I realized that, my goodness, we're so similar. Like, why can't we just explore, you know, those similarities and the differences? And that's what, you know, birthed the podcast, just as a way to keep adding to that conversation of, yeah, we're different. Yes, we might cook rice differently, but we all want to belong. We all want to connect. And how do I help people, you know, share their story and honor their process so you can look back in time and think of it like a timestamp, like, oh, I was once in this, you know, situation in life, or I was once in this placement. I've since moved on from this position, but I still want to honor mm-hmm. my path, my stories as well. Mm-hmm. Right now, yeah, I'm doing okay.
Like, honor the path and the story.
Honor the path. Yes, that's what I do. So I'm more of a cultural mm-hmm. archivist, and I just mm-hmm. want to archive stories. And I've been so fortunate to have wonderful guests on the podcast, because I say we have 303 episodes. If you've mm-hmm. done over 300 episodes, there's only so much of my life I can share in those episodes. Because I can only fit like 2-3 episode max, and I'm already burnt out. But mm-hmm. the guests, they make the podcast, because they come with their stories, and the trust they have that we're able to make something meaningful out of it is something I do not take for granted, you know. And so I'm very encouraged. We've won 2 awards, you know, Diaspora and Podcast of the Year, which means a lot. Mm-hmm. We have wonderful community, because it also helps them learn more about mm-hmm. other people, you know, and mm-hmm. just how to even learn 1 or 2 things to make their own lives better. So yeah, that's why I keep doing the podcast.
Yeah, congrats. Yeah, I think we especially live in a world where nationalism seems to be exploding and really preventing people from hearing each other. And I think here in the US in particular, we're seeing the damage done by not talking. And not
I know.
I think this is part of the reason why I'm here, is because I do believe in honoring like differences and different stories. And I think very much like you, I've always found similarities rather than differences when I meet new environments and people. Mm-hmm. And that just makes the experience so much more fun.
Right, I agree. And I feel like our voices need to be louder, because the people that speak so much and you hear them in those spaces, they're the ones that, the loudest voices aren't always the, you know, the kindest of voices. And for a lot of us, it's just like, I can't even deal, you know, I don't even want to be, but we need to be more vocal about just some of the values we have and the ones that bring people together the most. We don't really get to hear about that. It's the more divisive ones, the more, you know, evil ones that are so loud. And and yes, and thanks for speaking to that. So that's why we keep doing the podcast. And then for the second one, I'm doing much better now. If you had asked me 2 weeks ago, I probably would have been bawling. So I have a 6-year-old and an 11-month-old. So don't ask me why. I'm just crazy. But I moved them across the world, and they're here with me in Korea. So whenever I applied for the Fulbright, my mom was supposed to come with me. She was listed as a dependent to come help with my kids. But Fulbright assumed she was a U.S. citizen, which she's not. She's still a Nigerian passport holder. And I don't know if you know just about the moving across borders with the passports that people don't really tend to respect on a global level. So anyways, they had her, she was staying with us in the U.S. helping with the baby. They had her go back to Nigeria for her visa interview. I know. And it was a holding pattern that lasted for about 2 months. So I was stuck here with two kids in a new country, and it was so overwhelming. But now she finally made it here, and I'm so happy. I'm much better. I can finally breathe and be, because Korea is a place I always wanted to come to. Yeah. And this was before I had kids. So to have it hijacked by I love my kids, you know, but having kids and raising them and being responsible for them, those are really difficult things, you know. I'm doing much better now. Yeah, I'm doing much better now.
Wow, I'm so glad to hear that, because it's a great experience, but definitely need a lot of support for moving across the continent. And
thanks.
Going to be different. Even food is so different.
Oh, I know. Everything is different. Yeah, but we're making it work. It's the second month, and time is going by so fast that I'm in a hurry to just keep making the impact, because I came here for a purpose. So. Yeah, I have questions about your food Bible. We'll get to that. I'm just going to slide into the episode and then go on. But thank you so much for those questions. I love it. All right. So. Hello, everyone. We hope you enjoyed the pre-call to this episode. It was actually very nice to have a guest just, ask questions. I hardly have that happen. So thank you. So today's episode, we're traveling across borders, but not just geographic ones, guys, but emotional and cultural ones too. Our guest today is a global health pediatrician whose work reminds us that children's well-being is shaped as much by community and compassion as it is by medicine. Her mission is to build culturally sensitive, equitable systems that allow all children to thrive, especially those in underserved or displaced communities. She speaks 5 languages, guys, and has collaborated with teams in the US, China, Mexico, Chile, Haiti, Canada, and the DRC. Her research builds evidence around youth mental health and early childhood development, and her impact extends far beyond the clinic. She's an educator, a mentor to more than 100 young people across the world, and a certified mindfulness teacher and coach. In our conversation today, we'll explore her journey through immigration and multiculturalism and what it means to heal from trauma while helping others heal. Her mindfulness, mentoring, and purpose intersect in her life. We'll also talk about her Fulbright experience, the art of sustainable work-life integration, and the lessons she learns around leading with empathy in the global world. So settle in, everyone, for a thoughtful, heart-opening conversation with Dr. Xin Shi. She's a physician, educator, and a global citizen who's showing us what it means to practice medicine with both skill and soul. Hello, Dr. Shi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. This
is a really warm welcome, and knowing that you're just beginning your Fulbright journey brings me back to time of my Fulbright not long ago. So I'm really excited for you, and I'm just listening to kind of the overview of today's conversation makes me think that I might be able to understand certain things about myself and my path, actually, by answering these questions in one session.
Cannot wait to explore all that. So you have lived and worked across several countries, and you speak 5 languages. But let's start from the beginning. I always want to ask about the beginning. Can you tell us who Dr. Shi was before Dr. Shi was?
Yeah, of course. I think... I was born in China in the 80s, where things weren't as good as now today. People know China as this really strong economy that's grown tremendously. In the 80s, when I was living in Shanghai, where my parents were from, we still didn't have running hot water, so water still needed to be heated on the stove. Electricity would go out from time to time, and families really crowded in very small spaces. So for example, my parents and I lived in a room that's probably the size of a garage, like in the US, for a good 7 years. And my bed was a folding bed that would get unfolded every night to provide sleep. And I say all of that with a really kind of sweet childhood memory. But now that I've lived in a lot of countries and taken bucket showers, I now know that, you know, though it is still very common in many parts of the world, it is no longer the case in China. In many cities, for example, things have modernized and improved to the point that they put the U.S. to shame to a certain degree. I think back, though, in those nights where I was bucket showering at my grandmother's, or, you know, in the bathroom full of cockroaches. Those were the initiation days to my global health journey.
I was going to say that.
Because I was just like, oh, this is just like when I was little. And nothing, you know, nothing was too much. And I knew somehow that everything could change, that things could get better. The most important thing is that you have family and friends and, you know, things that you like to do. So I think very early on, I saw that sort of saw that material change of China from a pretty low resource country to a kind of middle income country. I also moved across the national borders twice. When I was 12, I moved with my parents to Spain.
What brought about that move, the first move?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. A lot of people think my parents are like business
missionaries.
They're missionaries, but my dad just was a college professor in China and was pretty disheartened by the Tiananmen Square, where a lot of people I think he didn't see much hope in the system being so cruel to young people. At the time, I think he also didn't want me to grow up in an environment where young people could be killed for just peaceful protests. So a lot of people actually left because of similar reasons. They're just very disappointed and oppressed, no freedom of speech, and also very little opportunity for people with new ideas to thrive in an environment where you're told to just listen and obey. So he left China when I was 7, and then we moved together at age 12. I was definitely a life-changing event. I didn't know where Spain was. I literally had to look it up in the map, so that was fun. Spoke no words of Spanish. Just got thrown into the environment, but you probably know from your kids, you know,
they
they're
pick up
going to
so
be
well.
speaking
Yeah.
Korean
Yeah.
and
Yeah.
in a few months. And that's what I did, just playing with other kids. And at age 12, you do have a sense of self already. So it was a little bit difficult to adjust to a completely different culture. But I think overall, still, the language was easy for me to learn. A lot of the school subjects were the same. So I took maybe 6 months to learn everything. And then after that, I just kind of jumped into school and social life. Same.
Oh, wow. As we were just talking, I was just, my head was just going like China to Spain and China to Spain. And how many years did you spend in Spain, by the way?
I was in Spain for 6 years. So middle school and high school. And I think just this one experience of being transplanted from one country to another, gave me the courage to seek out more, as you probably
yes,
did
you never
well.
Stop.
You drank the Kool-Aid, and
especially
just,
for people like us, there's almost like, when is the next one? You know?
There's like a gut feeling every few years of
like we gotta move, like a little gypsy, like you gotta move, like you know.
Exactly.
Wow.
I think that combined with teenager, you know, fantasy world and just wanting to see other places led me to the U.S. at age 18. I applied to a bunch of colleges and got into one close to one of my relatives' house in Philadelphia. So I had just this one relative, and then the rest of the world is new. And my parents, because I'm the only child, would never have let me go if there was no other
adult,
like supervising, basically. You know, the U.S. kind of known to be pretty wild. And in college, I met some of the best friends of my life. I decided to go to medical school. I met with my ex-husband at age 21 and fell in love. So I think it was just kind of like a little bit of a soap opera, actually, deciding to stay because didn't want to lose my first love for moving out of the country. And the rest was kind of history.
I think
the one big thing that happened also around junior year summer is that my grandmother got diagnosed with terminal cancer. So I had already started interviewing for PhD programs in the country. And I quickly decided to apply also to medical school just in case I could get in. I knew it was very hard. I was an F1 visa. So it was very uncertain whether I could get in at all, even with good grades and good background. But I did get in, and I also got a majority scholarship for medical school.
Congrats.
So that kind of paved my way to do things that I really wanted to do instead of being trapped with student loans and things like that. So yeah, I consider myself really, really fortunate. I remember the interview that led me to have that scholarship. I was completely unaware. Right? Like at age 22, you just have no idea how the world works. And this professor in medical school started discussing Buddhism with me during the interview. And I was like, this is so strange. I'm supposed to be here
for an interview.
Medical school, you know, interview on very technical things, why I want to be a doctor and what do I want to do with a medical degree. But he asked me what compassion meant. Because I had written about compassion. I said, my grandmother is dying. She has always wanted to be a physician, but was sick with tuberculosis and could never practice after medical school. And I'm the only grandchild who's willing to give it a try to get into medicine. And she's just thrilled beyond imagination that she could have one of her grandchildren go be accepted into medical school before she died. And, you know, we talked about what compassion meant in different cultures and different religions, what it is to see beyond your own ego and your existence. It was very philosophical. So I had a great time, but I was like, it seems like he's not very interested in admitting me because he just started talking about other stuff.
That's when you knew you got it. You know, whenever they just, you know, the interview is done, I already approved you, you know, this is just like a formality. Yeah.
Little did I know that, you know, a few weeks later, I got the acceptance letter with the scholarship, which is just such a game changer because my parents weren't enough.
That's quite expensive. Yeah.
And not only that, but my grandmother became demented 2 weeks after I got that letter. So it was just all very movie like and timely. I think something in the universe helped me get in and wanted my grandmother to know on the phone that I did get accepted before she left. So I think everything happens for a reason, you know. Losing a grandparent is definitely one of the most painful things, but it led me to this great opportunity that I otherwise wouldn't have access to,
especially when you consider how immigration also causes that separation in families. And we see that a lot, you know. Immigrants, like, you know, when my grandma died, I couldn't even make it to the funeral, you know. And my husband, whenever his twin brother got married, he couldn't make it to the wedding. And because, you know, you leave and then it's so hard to get back in because of visa issues. And I don't know what the situation was like in your case, but I just wanted to just add that to like the impact of immigration and the cost of that as well. And I'm sorry to hear about your grandmother, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
As a physician, I think I see death very different now than I saw it at age 21, but I still definitely felt like the first important death in my life. It was very life-changing because it led me to a career that I wasn't planning on having.
Okay. Thank you for all of that. So China and then 12 to Spain, and you found yourself in the US and you've been here ever since, right? And you said so many things there that I feel
I'm
like
still here.
That's why I said that, because I know with you, you kind of sound like me. Like, when is the next big adventure? So let's talk about let's spend a bit of time on just multiculturalism, especially from you know, the pediatric standpoint. And by the way, congrats on all of your accolades. You know, MPH, an MD degree. You know, female, and you also like FAAP, you know, faculty, the fellow, right? That's really great, by the way. So congrats on all of that. So, you know, you've seen health systems in both the East and West, right? Mm-hmm. And from your perspective as a pediatrician and researcher, what would you say are some unique challenges immigrant children face in balancing their cultural identity with the pressures to, you know, assimilate?
Yeah, that's a really profound question. I'm not sure I know all the answers, but from my perspective, I saw firsthandedly when my parents went to Spain the first time, they didn't know the language. And so I basically didn't see a doctor forever until I got sick one day, like eating some seafood. And that was the first encounter that I had with the health system. I think there's a lot of fear of just not knowing what you're doing and not trusting that people will treat you fairly and honestly, the fear of financial burden, of the cost of getting treated. In a lot of countries, China definitely one of them, there's supposed to be universal healthcare, but you also have to pay cash, like when you arrive at the hospital. So I think that was definitely one of the things my parents probably thought about, is not going to the hospital, like, because, you know, who knows how much this has cost. Like, this country is much more expensive than what we're used to. The other thing is language barrier. There were no interpreters. Nobody really spoke anything other than Spanish. My parents' Spanish, until this day, is still pretty broken.
What's that thing you hear about? If anyone that speaks a broken language, because they have, they're polyglots, you know, so kudos.
I'm like amazed now that I have learned a lot more about systems and languages, just how much my parents were able to do with their limited language skills. And how like everything just seems much more complicated when you don't understand what people are talking about.
Right.
And everything just seems so scary. I think in the US, we also often encounter different cultural beliefs on like the origin of illnesses. So in a lot of Eastern cultures and traditional cultures, it's believed that there's like some sort of a balance. You're off balance. So we're trying
harmonies,
to find a balance.
Exactly. Which is, I don't know why we cannot even adopt that as a fundamental principle, because it really is. It's a balance issue.
Exactly. And we are adopting that, right? Like with integrative medicine. They're actually repurposing or reframing traditional medical teaching into kind of a holistic view of medicine, mind-body interaction, and also using a lot of traditional methods to prevent illnesses rather than rescue emergencies, which is very much the center of allopathic Western medicine. It's just like, you know, we can fix your broken leg, but we have no idea how to treat your chronic back pain. And I very much think that there's complementarity in that, but there's also a lot of stigma. I remember in medical school, if anyone mentioned like they take herbal medicine, don't mention that to your preceptor, like that's not supposed to happen. And what I realize now is, first of all, like a lot of people have no idea what these herbs are, right? And then there's no systematic knowledge bank that helps doctors figure out like these traditional medicines and their philosophies. Three is, a lot of it is just arrogance also. It's this, ethnocentricity of that our system is the best system and everything else is just non-scientific, which is never really evidence-based. Right. It's just based on the belief. And that clashes with a lot of other cultures and other belief systems. I think now that I've gotten a lot into mental health research, I also think that's a huge challenge when it comes to explaining mental health in youth to family members. I think there's very different ways to understand individual versus family versus community. And it's all about finding common ground. It's kind of where we started at the beginning of this conversation, how you would ask people how they cook their rice, right?
Rice,
but just different spices.
Different ways.
I think it's the same thing a lot of times with health beliefs. Like we all want the same thing. We want to feel good in our body. We want to feel connected with our mind. And we want to have some sort of belief that we exist for a reason in this world. Mm-hmm. And I think different cultures just have different ways of telling the story of how these things all relate to each other.
Yeah.
And it's so beautiful when you have the time and the patience to sit down and listen to other versions of the explanation. I've always found that to be fascinating. That's why I'm in global health. But unfortunately, in Western medicine, a lot of times we have 15 minutes to see a patient, and that's just not realistic to really understand. But I think the educational system is changing these days to really emphasize on cultural humility, not cultural competency, because nobody can be competent in all cultures.
Yes, for sure.
Like I'm not even competent in my own family culture, you know?
Yes.
So it's just, it's more the openness of upholding multiple truths, of seeing that there are different ways to understand our body and our mind. I think that the same principle can really be used in many different occasions, political debates, medicine, and very specifically, I always ask my patients, like, so what's your understanding of why you're here? I think listening before you open your mouth is always a good idea as a doctor.
In life, yes.
As a mother, right? And just like, oh, so you broke the glass. Like, how do we get here?
Explain to me. Walk me back, you know, to how we got here. Yeah. I mean, there's so much to unpack for what you just said, and thanks for sharing of that, by the way. Mm-hmm. Just listening to you talk, it feels like you're a very good storyteller, very effective, and you evoke so many emotions, the right ones, when you're talking. Mm-hmm. And as we're talking about cultural sensitivity, which is like the height of cultural, you know, I mean, there's also cultural competence, like 7 steps to it. I'm mm-hmm. saying at the very least, just that humility to know that you don't know a lot of things, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, like the expert in all things that comes, it's your culture, how much more someone else's culture, but the ability to be humble and to listen, that's one. And in addition to the rice question, another way of just seeing out the differences, but just in a quirky way, is what is the sound a dog makes in your country? Like in a Nigerian culture, we say bo bo, like, you know, that's the sound of a dog. But an American would say woof woof. A Korean would say mong mong, you know. But you know,
oh, that sounds very different.
I know, it sounds very different. Yeah. Like mong mong, you know.
Which dog
is that? Okay, I get it, yeah. And then for cats, you know, we say meow meow. In Korean they say yao yao. I bet if I asked you, like in Chinese, you know, how do you guys, you know, relate the onomatopoeic sound of a dog barking? What is that in Chinese? In China,
dog barking is wong wong.
See, that sounds very weird to me, but okay, yeah. You know, yeah. I believe you. So whenever, because I always have interactions with, you know, international students, and we go around the table and I ask them, we end up just laughing, you know, because yeah. like, how does that make sense, you know? But then
how many yeah. different ways is
different
there
ways.
To like, say the same sound?
Same dog, you know?
Yeah.
So, I have so many questions for you. I feel like you need to come back in so many times on the podcast. As a pediatrician, you're not just dealing with the unit factor of the patient, right? You're also mm-hmm. dealing with families, which I imagine is very mm-hmm. overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And you're not just talking about the body, but also working on the mind, you know, with your mental mm-hmm. health component of it. Now, and there's also that immigration layer to it. If you're working in settings where there's so many, you know, international immigrant families being part of it. Now, how do you, and I have had my bouts with mental health issues even as a mm-hmm. child, and I'll have family members lovingly tell me, oh, you should need to pray more, you can't be depressed. Mm-hmm. As early as being, when I was 9, I remember telling my mom I need to see her, you know, I think I said psychiatrist, and she looked at me mm-hmm. very weirdly, because mm-hmm. I just felt like something was off in my mind. I needed to talk to mm-hmm. someone, and they didn't have the resources. Thank God I was able to, whenever I moved to the US, I was able to have access to that. But mm-hmm. all that to say that mental health issues growing up were not things that were openly discussed. It's getting better now. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, you know, how do you translate mind, body ideas, you know, especially balance, which we talked about, you know, with lack of mm-hmm. when we have, like, you know, disease happening and how we define it. How do you translate those mind, body ideas into language that resonates with immigrant parents who may be wary of mental health labels, especially when it comes to their, you know, mm-hmm. their progenies, as it were?
Mm-hmm. I think one advantage that we pediatricians have is that we're used to talking to children. So we're used to using very simple language. In fact, one of the first things we teach when medical students come to rotate in our department is do not say anything that you think your next door neighbor or your grandmother would not understand. Mm. Right? So we're talking about these complex conditions that maybe some of the patients have never heard of in their lives, but we're asking students to really try hard to explain it in layman's terms. So I think it's kind of beaten into us pediatricians to always talk in a language that even a third grader would understand. And with little, you know, with children even younger, we basically are body language, you
right,
know, signaling,
right. How much
sign
yeah.
language,
yeah.
you know, making sounds. But yeah, I think with families, we are very used to assuming nothing, assuming that they don't know anything, and then ask them what they want to know. Because also, in some cultures, like, people don't want to know that, you know, their kid has cancer maybe right away. Maybe you have to explain to them something else, like, you know, their blood counts are really high and we need to give them some transfusions to make sure that they stay well. And then, you know, little by little kind of peel off that onion and get to the bigger picture diagnosis. But I think our skills are there of explaining things that are very complex into very simple words.
Simple words.
So like dehydration, we sometimes just say like he lost more water than he was able to drink. You know, things like that. It's very much part of our talking to patients every day. And these days we all do like family-centered rounds, which means that it's a conversation between us and the family, sometimes with the patient, if they're old enough to have a conversation. I think the immigrant families are especially complex. I do teach my students a lot to do a thorough social history, you know, where they come from, like who lives at home. Because nowadays also we can't assume that it's like dad and
mom, kids. Yes. Like,
there's so many families where there's
ask questions,
grandparents,
yeah.
uncle's two children. And I live in San Francisco where a lot of diversity, but a lot of
family, exactly. So, you know, safe cost,
multi-general housing is pretty common. And also like how does the child relate to all of them? When it comes to mental health, it's almost impossible to understand the mental health of a child without understanding the whole family, especially the people who live with the child. And oftentimes, the problem is not the child, but the adults in the home. They have unresolved psychological issues that they're not willing to acknowledge because of stigma or, you know, access to care or ways of understanding that have helped them avoid dealing with it directly for years. Sometimes religious beliefs can really you know, lead people to believe that they don't need help. They need to go to church more. I've heard that from like Trevor Noah's comedy show. He's always making fun of
African friends, I mean, it can be both. You can go to church and still seek mental health services.
Right,
those two
things
are not mutually exclusive, Jesus and therapy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's always my thought. It was like,
you
know that prayer works. Like prayer has been researched to really help when you are going through a really hard time with physical illnesses. But why does it have to be only prayer?
Right.
Prayer and some medications. You can do chemotherapy and some
prayers.
Yoga.
Tai Chi.
You can drink juice all day and eat some healthy, balanced diet. It's all very compatible. So I think, it's very much about finding a point where, you know, people can reach an agreement on what are some things that they're willing and open to do in order to feel better. I mean, that's pretty much the ultimate goal is everybody to feel that they're healthier or they're more well or they're more balanced, if that's the way they understand it. I think, using the other person's vocabulary and making sense of their story and their ways of telling you how they got to where you are. That meeting point. There's so much. I read some stats about how like patients spend 0.6% of their life in the medical system, right?
0.6%, but that 0.6% feels like a lifetime to some patients because of just how overwhelming it is.
Yeah, and it's a very vulnerable time. But you know, I think we, as doctors, we really have to understand majority of time they're thinking about other things. They have other priorities. Yeah. And, you know, we think that, you know, sometimes their mental health is their biggest priority. But maybe they have to pay the bills for
right.
Like depression can wait. I'm gonna feed my children and then feel depressed afterwards.
Right.
Their food needs to be on the table. And so that also, I mean, it is one of the sort of unique things also I think about immigrant communities that I've met in the world. Like some immigrants are internal immigrants, right? Like displaced from one place to another in the same country.
Yes.
Others have had to cross borders, but ultimately they're looking for better opportunities. And in searching for better opportunities, sometimes they postpone taking good care of
themselves. Yeah, so when they have families, not even immediate families, but families they have to send money to back home, and the stress, you know, that comes from that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's two sided. In a way, it can be a good thing, right? Like it's like that's a survival.
Yes, to keep going. Yeah.
Responsibility. Mm-hmm. You have to be tough. It helps you. It helps you to stand up tall and get the shit done. But I think at the same time, it doesn't make sadness or anxiety go away.
No.
It just buries it for some time. And then at some point, it's going to have to come out. And unfortunately, these emotions sometimes come out in the most inconvenient moment.
Boy, yeah.
And that's when it becomes a problem.
Thanks so much for... I feel like there's so many questions. The more you just keep answering my questions, I'm coming up with more. I have to bring you back for a special panel, especially with intergenerational processing of trauma and how, because we're seeing a lot of things in our community. For so many of my seniors who moved here many years ago, their kids being born in a separate culture than the one they grew up with, there's a communication gap between their expectations and what the kids think the parents want from them. Like, I'm not Nigerian like you. I'm American. But then the parents are like, you're still Nigerian. And those conflicts sometimes create for a chasm, as it were. And the kids are pulling away. And, you know, that also just causes more shifts in the family dynamics. So, and then, of course, there's also some mental health issues I can imagine. Because, you know, when kids are not, especially with social media and peer pressure, they're not like new things, but some of these families, especially the older generation, are not able to really understand or even provide the kind right amount of support that their children, you know, need or their loved ones need. So it would be nice to like have someone like you who has, you know, seen it all, you know, as a parent, as a physician, as a mental health advocate, and even as a public health practitioner, to be able to speak to some of those dynamics. That would be very, very great. Also, as an immigrant, I think that's like the overarching layer. So I would love to bring you back to explore more on that and provide some help to our communities.
Thank you. Yeah. I saw that you had a panel on youth mental health.
I did. I had someone who attempted suicide at 8. I had a psychiatrist. I had a psychologist. And we just tried to talk about providing some form of support. So the next question I have for you is with this, but I'll first preface it by, I think it was a quote by Rezma Menakem. I think he said trauma isn't something that happens to us, it's what we carry when we have to keep going, right? And you've worked a lot with, you know, youth mental health and early childhood development. What strategies have you found to be most effective for helping children process trauma, especially when they have not yet developed the language to express what that is, the trauma that is?
I'm not sure. I'm humbled that you consider me to be an expert in the area. I have seen a lot of trauma. I've heard of a lot of trauma. I've witnessed a lot of trauma in my years working in places like Haiti. And I've seen some things work. I think playfulness is actually one of the most robust counteracting elements against trauma for younger children. I think part of it is that it doesn't require a high level of language capacity or complex abstract thinking, you know, a lot of talk therapy for adults really requires you to be able to think
through
emotions, like becoming aware of your internal thoughts, like all of those faculties. A young child like under 7 might just find it really impossible. Also, kids work a little bit differently than adults. They're actually more embodied, right? Like they're like getting to know the world through touch and scent, and they like getting dirty and you know, just exploring the world more directly. So actually, I've seen both in Haiti and in places like Tijuana, Mexico, where there are a lot of refugees coming from extreme violence, respond really well to just being a kid and playing with whatever. Like, and in Haiti, we did this intervention where we went to kids' homes and literally just looked around and put maybe like a few stones in an empty Coke bottle and shook it around, and they just like laughed, like it's the funniest thing they've ever seen. And we know that works because parents may not have the money to go to a toy store. There are no toy stores in many
exactly
places.
How much more the money to buy that, because you want to prioritize fooding and accommodation and you know that kind
and
of
transportation
stuff.
Is always an issue.
But
kids don't care. Like, you just have to be creative about using the environment as a playground and actually giving them the attention that they need. One thing that really struck me as a mother was when I went to Tijuana to do my research on parenting and family mental health in the refugee shelters, is how little I had learned about this in my own parenting. Like, I've been hopefully a good pediatrician for a good 10 years before I had my daughter, but nobody taught me how to be a parent. Like even the observational tools that we used to say, for lack of better words, to grade the parents in their interactions with the children, make me think so much about things that I could do better with my daughter. Things like letting her lead the imaginary play, right? Like, where does she want this game to go? Instead of me always
having
setting
a bit
goals.
She
it doesn't have to be that way. It could be like watching her body language, seeing how she's like turning her wheels inside of the head to come up with new ways to play.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for that. And I love your emphasis on play therapy. My friend, Dr. Dem, she's a pediatrician. She made a statement. We had a panel for like parents and education and advocating for your kids. Like, children are so cheap. They don't need much. Just, you know, give them a compliment, pat them on the back, or just do something that lights up their day. And that goes a long way, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think universally, they need love. Easier said than done. They really need accompaniment, like, because sometimes we are with our children, but we're not necessarily paying attention to them. Even I think as a mother, and that's very challenging, right? Because we have
so much things exactly like, we're doing, and if you have more than one kid, it's like a lot of attention grabbing. It's like, can I just breathe?
This is something that I realized maybe in the last 2 years. They need us to be the best versions of ourselves.
But we don't remember that, right? We neglect ourselves because we do it the opposite way. Like, let me make them so good. And then we get burnt out and then we get cranky. And it doesn't make for, like, great parenting.
This you'll see a lot in Korea, because Korea is very similar in China in that it's a highly pressurized society. Kids get to sent to extracurricular
at
a very young age.
Yep.
And, you know, if you ask parents, like, why do you do that? Like, the kid is just 6 years old. Like, let him, you know, have some free time. And they're like, oh, no. Like, I want him to be successful. I want him to be go to, like, Seoul University. Yeah. He needs to start now.
Yes. And it's that thing of upward uprising. Those is, I don't know if you saw the new study that just said that the youngest children, children under 10, the cases of antidepressant use has doubled since 2020.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm 104%.
Surprised, right? 104%.
Like,
That is gangsta.
I mean, I think the intention is good.
Yeah.
But if you like understand why they're doing that, it's because there's so much underlying anxiety. And that can happen with a lot of immigrant families too, because they survived so much difficulty to get to where they are now. They feel like there's no time to waste, right? Like their kids are in the best position possible and they just need to keep forward, push forward. But it's a lot of projection of their own insecurities, which they have for a good reason, because they came from really tough situations where you don't have safety.
Yeah.
Neither physical safety nor financial safety, let alone emotional safety, right?
Yeah.
But they don't, I feel like a lot of times they're not aware of that. That's their own anxiety and maybe their own childhood speaking.
That is
coming out,
yeah. But
they're affecting their next generation of children who don't have to.
Yes, they don't have that context,
They don't have to be this unsafe anymore. And that's the whole point of you immigrating to the U.S. Your kids are a little bit safer and don't have to go through the same anxiety-provoking situations. But I think it's very hard for humans to turn off that habitual way of looking at things once we're in that high-stress setting. So, yeah, I think it's very ironic in Asia these days. I see a lot of parents like really worried about their children. But when you look at them and the way they sign up their kids for like 1,800 classes, you're like, you seem like you have a lot of anxiety.
Maybe let's talk about your anxiety, you know.
About your parenting anxiety than about your kids not having enough extracurricular activities.
Somebody needs to come up with like a Maslow hierarchy of scale, but like for immigrant family, like we end up, because when you talk about safety or helping their kids, there needs to be like a renewed operational definition of it. Because for them, they've helped their kids because now you don't have to worry about food on the table. You talked about growing up in cramped housing. Now you have a roof over your head. You have a whole room to yourself. I have done more for you. So for them, that is safety. The mental health part of it feels very nebulous. Like, why are you anxious? Why are you depressed? You didn't have to worry about things I had to worry about.
Yeah.
But in the child's mind, like, these are real issues, right? And the child will also have to go through their own processing. Because I feel like anyone that has to go through life, there's this trauma with life. Mm-hmm. Good or bad, there's just trauma with life. And then the one from the parents as well, you know, through the parenting skills. Man, what tangled web we weave. And I know that parents try to do right by their kids. But if we're not connected to ourselves, you know, like I said, like when I became a parent, I had to start going to therapy because it brought out some parts of me I didn't even know existed.
Oh yeah, you know? Totally. Yeah.
Like the reaction with my daughter, like, it's like, this is not who I am. Like, why am I so reactive? Why am I so on edge, you know, about certain things she does or certain things she says? And I haven't stopped going to therapy. I mean, I have been in therapy before she came into my life, but like therapy specifically for parenting, I've had to go through, you know, several sessions of that just to understand, why is this so new to me? Why am I, you know, so anxious? Why am I so, you know? So yeah, I'm very open to share that. Like, you know, we all need resources as parents, especially mental health resources, because some of these things we just need to work through them.
I'm so glad you did seek help, because the biggest problem, well, I think there are several big problems with mental health these days. One is access. You know, even in a place like San Francisco, there's a waiting list for youth mental health therapists. And then two is just like time
and the
recognition that it is something
it's important. Yes, yes. Or even money time. You know, money and time. Or even if it's worth, like you said, is it worth, you know, spending time? Is it even gonna work? Is it effective?
There's a lot of stigma. I mean, there's still a lot of stigma. I think in a lot of my research projects in China, we have to really frame it as a kind of life skill teaching instead of like mental health prevention.
Issues, yeah,
people
yeah.
will always be like, oh, like my child doesn't have mental health problems, or like, what is a mental health problem? You know, explain to me, why is that important? So I think something about, you know, talking about it more like an emotional regulation skill or a resilience skills training, so that their kids can withstand more stress and do better academically,
yeah.
you know, kind of
yeah.
speaking their language is sometimes the way to get people to become interested.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for all of that. Now, you juggle multiple roles, right? Physician, researcher, educator, mentor, mom, mindfulness coach. I'm always curious to know, how do you personally, people like you with, you know, such achievement and so multi roles, how do you personally define that work-life integration rather than balance, and what has helped you?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question, because I, for the longest time, didn't like the word work-life integration. It's very much used, I think, and it's more of a more accepted way of talking about it. I think I have always prioritized my own wellness. And that's something I learned from my burnout. So as a global health fellow in Haiti, I was there for on and off 2 years. And I had to witness more than 300 pediatric deaths. Sometimes I didn't have the help that I needed to resuscitate babies, and I had to watch them die of preventable lack of resources like oxygen and very basic medical treatments. So I think because of that experience, I had to spend 4 months kind of recovering from all of it. I during those 4 months, I basically didn't want to hear or talk about anything related to medicine or Haiti or my experience there. And I wasn't sure I was going to be able to really become involved again, because it was so, in a way, like traumatizing to me. It's kind of like trauma by witnessing it. But I did come back. And after 4 months, I realized, oh, like, I thought that if I was just there to serve people and help people, I would be happy, like, because that's the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my life. But that is not enough. And it is also not automatic that when your life has purpose, you can be sustainably doing it for a long time, right? Like, for 2 years, I was doing it. After 2 years, I burnt out. And
wow.
It would be a shame for me to like never touch global health again, because I only helped for two years, and that's not nearly enough help, even from a personal scale level. Like I could definitely do more if I wasn't burnt out. So that led me to think that prioritizing self-care and just this internal awareness of where you are in terms of your state of mind is super important to do anything in life. And I think there's a gender theme here too. I think women in many cultures are very much raised to be caregivers and to prioritize others' needs before our own. I mean, I saw it in my grandmother, I saw it in my mother. I did it for a while in my own family. I did it as a professional. You know, it's very much like patients first. You know, these populations, they're much more underserved than my own family and my own circle of friends. So, you know, what reason do I have to not, you know, sacrifice a night's sleep or just keep going, right? Like, until I can't do it anymore. But the keep doing part is actually tricky. I think if you don't pace yourself, you're actually not going to be as effective in the world if you took good care of yourself. And that's not selfish. I think I really had to, I mean, it sounds like common sense to me now, but it really didn't back then. Like, I believed in all those big ideals with, well, my mentors, who, by the way, majority were white men who left their children with their wives for 3 months at a
time. They have no idea.
Didn't have any family obligation, but they were, you know, seen as pretty awesome people, which they were, but it's not a model that's very female friendly or like, you know, culturally adaptable in many environments. It's also like someone's doing also part of the labor, right?
Yes.
So I think, my first realization of that I really didn't have a good work-life balance was during the burnout. And that led me to consider it to be my priority. Like I basically said, hey, if I want to make a difference in the world sustainably, I need to really prioritize my own wellness first. And I beginning to do a lot of research and kind of programs in the U.S. I became the wellness champion for our Department of Pediatrics at Stanford. I organized a lot of events in the hospitals because doctors are notoriously bad at taking good care of
themselves. It's a parenting thing, you know.
And it's a very high stress system. It's basically plotted to like be a workaholic and not have work-life balance. So it really needs a lot of change in culture. And I do see it in the next generation, my medical students, like fellows, some of the undergrad students that I mentor these days, they very much are more aware and more willing to ask for a break for their own mental health. And I think that's a good thing. I think about work-life integration nowadays because things like this, right? Like I am agreeing to being interviewed by you on a Wednesday night where I could be watching a movie or going out. But there is something about this conversation about our overlapping interests in transcultural learnings that really appealed to me. So I think I these days very much one prioritize wellness. So if my Sundays are to spend with my daughter, I'm not scheduling anything at all. I don't care if it's a huge grant from the Gates Foundation. I would just say no. So there are like hard limits. And then there are things that I'm willing to be flexible for that I think is good for my personal growth. And I think growth is important. So first is like knowing where my limits are and putting them on my schedule. Like Sundays are sacred, you know, post-call days, no meetings. And then I'll schedule like random lunches with my friends just to catch up and have social connection. And then I'll leave a little bit of flexibility for doing things that I don't have to do, but I know I'm going to enjoy doing. And that could be professionally, that could be personally, or that could just be curiosity. Like, I tried out like rock climbing in the gym just because I was curious what would that feel like. I don't have to do it. I don't have intention of making it a regular habit, but I know it was going to be a challenge that teaches me something that helps me to grow physically, but also maybe socially, like going there with my friends would be really enriching. I do think that, you know, the integration piece, I do see it because it means that some of this work is going to bleed into your personal life. So, you know, for example, next month, I'm taking my daughter down to Tijuana again. That was where I did my Fulbright.
Yes, out of the Comexos, I think,
Her third year celebrating her birthday in the refugee camps.
Wow.
And we generally buy, you know, plenty of pizza for about 25 people. We bring like salad and pizza and birthday cakes and celebrate it with some of similar age kids and their families who are helping out with the nonprofit.
Wow.
It's just a small ritual. It started with my work, but it's very much part of our family history now, just having this experience. And it is one of those things that I remember thinking, wow, I forgot that I was at work. Like, I thought that I was just celebrating my daughter's birthday, with a bunch of women sitting next to me and eating pizza. Like, how great would it be if work was just, you know, interacting with people who have interesting experience and sharing our struggles as parents and as women in society. And it turned out like that was part of my job too.
Yeah.
I do feel like there are moments where I see very blurry the line between work and personal, and those
that's
are
a
the
goal.
Moments,
yeah.
But those are the moments that make you really happy, and you stop thinking so much in terms
about
of
work.
Am I doing this for work or am I doing this for a personal reason?
Yeah. And I want to say not everyone has that privilege. But for the kind of person that I am and growing up, I knew that I had to find a job that wouldn't feel like a job to me. Otherwise, my mental health would just get all mushed up. So I do the job I love. And I had to make a lot of sacrifices for that to happen. I'm not cut out for a 9-to-5. By 9-to-5, I'm not talking about a 9-to-5. I mean, like, where you had to clock in and clock out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there downsides to that? Yes. I carry work with me everywhere. I could be on vacation and I have my laptop open because I have, a grand view. You know, sometimes those lines are blurred, but that's my trade-off. And I know how to I'm trying to work, make that balance, you know, work. Mm-hmm. My husband has he's a physician. So he goes to work, he comes back home. He doesn't have to bring work home with him. But while he's at work, it's like, you know, hard ground. He's having to like do stuff there. And it's a matter of life and death. I don't want that kind of responsibility on me. So there are trade-offs. And I think when you know your personality type and what will work for you, and you do a job that doesn't make it seem as if you're working per se, I could still do this job if I'm not getting paid for it, which is why I know I love what I do. And it's given me the opportunity to do other things that I like to do, like, you know, having a podcast and being able to travel on a Fulbright, you know. And I'm still, you know, on a payroll from work because that is still part of how I wanted it done. So again, it's knowing what works best for you and going for that kind of life. And that would help with that integration as well. That's my personal philosophy on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like for you, it required a lot of self-knowledge.
Definitely.
What you liked, what you're willing to give up, what's important, also what your family is able to tolerate.
To help with. Yeah, and sacrifice because there's a lot of emotional labor. Yeah, I mean, coming here, a lot of people had to sacrifice for that. And I had to know what the cost was going to be. Having those difficult conversations with my husband, what that separation will look like because he can't, you know, work from Korea. He's not able to do that, you know. So he has to come and go and visit. And me here with two kids. Yeah. And having to bring my mom, her being away from her husband. So a lot of people had to lay down a lot of things for this to happen. So I don't take that for granted. And even though I'm here living the Fulbright life, I'm also very sober about the thought that there were a lot of displacements and a lot of emotional labor that has to be paid for me to be here. And I'm very thankful for that.
But I think part of it is just people seeing that you're passionate about what you do and you're happy doing it. You're not just doing it to put it on your resume or to look good. Like, I think people know, I don't know where this quote is from, but I think it might from The Alchemist by
Paulo Coelho.
Just like when you're really onto the right thing, the universe conspires to help you.
I love that. The conspiracy.
Like I used to think that's such like non-scientific literature, but I don't know. I really do think that after a lot of experiences that are really painful,
yes,
then you all of a sudden grow. You're like, oh wow, like this is what I was supposed to do.
I'm
not supposed to like just stay back there and be comfortable. I am supposed to be here and like realize how much I have advanced since.
And you're right. One of my friends who's a psychiatrist always talks about finding meaning. You have to find meaning in your trauma or things you've gone through that are negative. You have to describe that, what that meaning is going to be like. It might take you years, but your ability to ascribe meaningfulness towards that issue is part of your growth process, right? And for me, I learn as I go. And I always try to take, sometimes I live my life like I'm a I'm an active bystander, watching myself and watching mm-hmm. things unravel, not in a helpless form of way, but I'm using that as a way to, I have an ability to almost like create avatars of myself when I'm going through stuff. Mm-hmm. And it also helped me, you know, process a lot of the trauma that I went through as a child, and, you know, and also ascribing meaningfulness towards it. And I've gone through so many things that have broken me and not make me, you know, still put together like this. But all that mm-hmm. to say that one of the biggest things in life for me is always find that meaning. And it's always the present progressive. Mm-hmm. There's some meanings I've found to the fullest, but some that I still, you know, it's constantly progressing and I'm learning more and more as I go.
Absolutely. And a lot of it is through actually seeing that other people go through very similar struggles.
Exactly.
And you realize that maybe your struggle was this token of connection that you needed to connect to these people who are sitting next to you, who you would otherwise have nothing in common with.
Right.
But even just that piece of memory going back to the trauma or going back to something really unpleasant is the start of a conversation that ends up bringing you meaning to your life and also to the person who you're talking to.
Yes.
If you resonate in that.
Yep. And that makes life great, you know, because you realize that it's a human experience.
Yeah.
Toss of a die, anything can happen to anybody, good or bad. Like, I never want to never have bad experiences, but my prayer is that I want to have more good experiences than, because the bad experience actually keep me very humble. The kind of person I am, mm-hmm. I can get things done, you know, but my spikes, my sufferings have humbled me. They've made me tender and they've made me more attentive. I can sense suffering in people. I gravitate towards, you know, and that makes me slow down a little bit and sit down and hold hands. Otherwise, I'm just on the go because I want to just get things done. I get a high from just getting things done.
Yeah.
There's no stopping me. So I'm thankful to God that He chose the version of suffering He's given to me. That said, God, you know, I've had enough. I just want a bit of smooth sailing from now on. But it's that human connection, being able to see other people and see that, wow, I have been through that. Can I work with you with this? You know, here's what helped me. Or I don't even have the words for what you're going through, because even though I've been through that, I can't even say if I can for sure say what you're going through is exactly what I'm going through, but I can hear you. I want to listen to you. I want you to know that you're not alone in this. Can I work with you, even if it's for a while? Can I hold some of your baggage for you? It's just, I think that's what makes us human, being able to empathize and see suffering in others and, you know, help them understand that, hey, you're not alone in this. I can see you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly that.
That's
at the core of so much connection
and
much healing, is just to feel heard and seen, and we can do that for each other. So everybody can be seen.
Thank you. I have lots of questions for you, but I need to wrap it up because I know your time has been fast spent. So you mentioned your daughter a lot. And she sounds like someone that is having your birthday in refugee camps and traveling to Mexico and all of that. Sounds like, you know, you're already making like a global citizen already. How old is she, by the way?
She's 7, just 1 year.
My daughter is 6. Wow. What a life. That's my goal for my daughter.
Are you coming back to the U.S. after the Fulbright?
Sadly, yes. But if you ask me, I feel like I should just stay here forever because I love it. But again, I will have to come back. But knowing the kind of person I am, this is not going to be the end of my migrations. But don't just tell my husband that yet, because he's just like, wow. we'll cross that river when we get to it. But I want to ask about your Fulbright journey. So you did the Comexus, and I imagine that was almost you paying a homage to your time in Spain and choosing a country where, because I know for the Mexico one, the Fulbright Mexico one, you have to be fluent in Spanish. So I just wanted to know what inspired you to apply and when you did it. So you did yours in 2023 to 2024, right? Which was like, you know, last year.
Yeah.
How did you know this was time for you, and why Mexico?
I mean, it's a great question. I think it was a pandemic baby of mine. Like, I was just sitting there and like scratching my head of what to do and what are the next steps, and nothing was certain. So I was like, why not? I mean, very low chance, but I might as well, because there's nothing else to really dream about. And I think it was very much like a dream that came out of sitting around a lot and wanting to get more involved. It was a build up though, because before the pandemic, I went down to Tijuana to volunteer at the border because of the first Trump administration family separation. I remember I was like 3 or 4 months postpartum, very hormonal still. Wow. Like just listening to the sound of a boy being separated from his sister and his teddy bear, I think was just like the most terrible like squeaks that you could even imagine any human being like hear another kid cry like that. I had to park on the side of the street to cry. Like I just couldn't see very well, and I didn't feel like it was safe for me to keep driving. So that's when I knew I had to go down there and see for myself what I can do. I knew I spoke Spanish. I knew there were also some Haitian refugees. So I know like language-wise, I was going to be somewhat helpful. I know there's generally a need for pediatricians when there's a lot of kids. And we know that like half of most displaced populations is under 21 years old. So I went down there, you know, trying to see what I can help with. And I got connected with this group of physicians and volunteers at Stanford that does work at the U.S.-Mexico border. And in California, we have that direct border between San Diego and Tijuana, which is, by the way, one of the biggest crossings in the world for immigrants and refugees. So I went down there and basically didn't feel like I could really practice medicine there, because it does require a Mexican license, or at least practice under the supervision of a local doctor, which I totally think, you know, I respect. That should be the case for most countries. But I had the language skill and I really love kids. So I just volunteered at a nonprofit that provided early childhood education. And at the end of that 1 week experience, I remember, you know, I was teaching, I think, 3 to 9 year olds in the classroom setting, like 20 of them. Every day we did these circles where we talked about like one good thing and one sad thing that happened in the last 24 hours. It's a kind of a Montessori model where there was a lot of attention paid to social emotional growth. Anyway, but I was really worried that these kids were going to get attached to me for that week and then I'm going to leave. So then I feel guilty causing them more separation, anxiety, and trauma.
Yeah, yeah.
So I said very clearly on Monday, like, I'm a volunteer here. I'm going to be here for 5 days. I have to go back and see my daughter. She was only like, I think 2 years old or something. And like, I couldn't leave for very long. And so the kids said, oh, okay, you know, we understand. We see a lot of volunteers. And there comes Friday, and they gave me an onion hug, which is like 4 by 25 kids.
Yeah.
And you know, it was nice and happy. I was a little bit sad, but it was generally a really good feeling. Until I peel off like these kids one by one, the parents came and went home. I got to the last girl, and I knew she was gonna have a hard time because her mom didn't come with her and her dad to the border. I think she had to stay behind to take care of grandparents. So she sort of found me as the substitute mother for the week. Mm. And she's just very, very attached to me. She gave me a drawing that is still like sitting on my vision board. I just like get so moved by this drawing. She didn't want to go back to her dad. So I, you know, waited for 10, 15 minutes and I was like, okay, this is getting ridiculous. Like they're closing the school and I have to go. And also like the dad's waiting outside the door. So I like kneeled down and, you know, hugged her and said, you know, I really appreciate your love and all your affection. I really have felt that heart to heart. And no matter where you go in the future, you will have other people who love you back and who support you, and you can do anything that you want in your life. And in saying that, I just like started bawling because I think as a mom, you know, that's sort of something you would say to your own kid and you want them to believe in it. But I realized this might be something that she carries with her for a long
time.
And it made my job in San Francisco so mundane compared to this moment that I felt like I was actually making a difference in this child's life. And there, if I had time, there are so many other hundreds of kids at the refugee shelter I haven't even come into contact with. If I just gave them a hug every day, that would do a lot to them feeling welcomed and not rejected and not, you know, abandoned by society and uprooted from their own cultures and religions. So I just felt like I had to go back. So the next year I went back, kind of did the same thing, met a lot of teachers, started talking about what other needs are there in the community. And because I'm a pediatrician, there are always parents coming to me, asking me about medical advice, like what their kids have, showing me skin rashes and things like that. And invariably, you know, these kids would be fine physically, at least what it seems like. They generally have a cold or they have some sort of a rash I can treat them very easily with.
Yeah.
But these parents just seem so overwhelmed. They would cry when I tell them that, you know, when I tell them it's a virus, it's probably going to get better in 5 to 7 days. You can just see, like, it's in a mix of relief and guilt. Like,
yes, mixture. And those two things can exist at the same time, right?
Yeah, like, I am the cause of the misery in my kid's life. And I'm like, no, you are the reason why your kid's alive. But I can see how that guilt is so deep in them as refugees, and they just don't feel like they're enough for their kids. So after talking to the parent, to the school teachers, we decided to propose a study to support parents in the refugee.
And that went into your Fulbright?
That went into my Fulbright.
Look at that.
So one thing led to another. I'm sure you know this feeling of just coming across something or someone that years later you realize was the beginning of your idea.
Yes, but of course you didn't know when you come across this person. Wow. Now, did you take your daughter with you to the Fulbright?
I did. So she went to a local school. So her Spanish is still very fluent. I speak to her in Spanish at home. She thinks she's Chinese Mexican American.
What's her Spanish name?
Clara.
Oh, Clara. Tan bonita.
Yeah. No, she speaks with a Mexican accent. She's only been to Spain a couple of times for vacation, so her accent is definitely Mexican.
Vosotros?
Yeah. We should say, like, ahorita. That's a very Mexican.
It has
expressions that are very, very northern Mexican.
That is great. And I love that you still keep giving her that immersion into that culture by taking her there, so that way she still keeps it, right? Right. Mm-hmm. So I know real quick, you do speak 5 languages, so English, Spanish, Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Cantonese, French?
I speak another Chinese language called Shanghainese. It's from the city of Shanghai. I asked my linguist friends, they're like, can other Chinese people understand you when you say it?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, they don't. So he said, well, then it's a language, it's not a dialect. I used to think it's a dialect.
It was dialect, yeah. Wow. And so Shanghainese, what's the fifth one?
Yeah, and I speak Haitian Creole.
Haitian Creole?
Yeah, I know. It's kind of random.
How much you speak a little bit of French? How did you learn Creole? Like,
well, because I lived in Haiti for 2 years. And
so you're one of those language magnets. You just go into a place, you assimilate the language. Oh, dang it.
It's learning a lot by harder definition. As adult. I definitely recommend, you know, what you're doing for your kids is really amplifying their exposure to languages. I think as a kid, learning was so much easier. I think Creole was definitely the hardest to learn, but after 2 years, that I was able to carry out conversations with my patients.
I speak English, of course, Yoruba, which is a Nigerian language, French, but I'm not very fluent as I used to be because I didn't use it. I'm learning Spanish. I've been doing that for more than a year now, and then Korean. So yeah, but it's
very different.
So different scripts. It's a confusion. I tried picking up Japanese and I was like, okay, no, I can't do this at the same time. It's just so many things going on. But yeah. I love the opportunity to just go through text because language is kind of like, there's a way I have different personalities with each of the language I'm learning. I'm more tender and more attentive when I speak Korean just because of the cultural nuances infused in a language. And also as an adult learner, you're always very conscious of, I don't want to go say the wrong thing or use the wrong honorific. So there's that tenderness and that softness that comes with speaking Korean. Unlike my mother tongue, usually when I'm talking to somebody in Yoruba, my daughter goes, "Mommy, are you fighting?" I'm like, "No, we're just having a conversation." <We're not fighting." laughs> But I could never speak Korean with that form of, aggression as the way that my daughter would ascribe it to. But I always advocate for language learning. I say, there's never a time that it's too late for you to learn a new language. Just find that language. There's always a language for you. Find it and just go with it, So, yeah.
So, I think so. And the best way to learn is to actually be in the country. So, I think, you're definitely modeling that for your kids.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for reminding me of that. I don't think too much about, I know she's getting the best out of it. My goal was for her to get a school and get extracurricular activity that she loves and then make it net positive for her. Because once she's okay, I'm okay. Because again, as a being your 6-year-old, they are conscious of the fact that there's a move. Like, "Mom, we're not in Oklahoma anymore." So every day as often as I can, I keep checking in with her. "So how are you doing? Are you loving it?" And she's like, "Yes, mommy, I'm having fun." Okay, that's great. Mission accomplished. So I have a question about fluoride. In addition to the research aspect of it, which, for people like you and I came to Korea because I wanted to, I'm a scientist. I do cancer research. And my goal is to look at survivorship, in men with prostate cancer, because that's the work I do in the U.S., and see what are the similarities and also the differences, and how can we help support, cancer survivors in Korea like we're doing in the U.S. So it was born out of my own curiosity as a scientist, but also the cultural exploration of it. I have been immersed in the Korean culture for more than a decade, learning the language and, interacting with a lot of Koreans. Now, the opportunity to live here and be immersed in it is one I don't take for granted. But I'm curious, how did you... So you lived in Spain for a bit, you speak Spanish, you volunteered at the border during when that whole displacement happened, and then you found an opportunity to apply for your Fulbright to do your research. While you were doing your Fulbright, did you ever have this... Because I'm going through this phase right now, which I think whenever I would release this episode, it might not be relevant anymore, but I wanted to just honor that process. Where I feel like, oh my God, there's so much to do and I want to get started. Especially with the cultural exploration, right? Now, my research bit of it, I have a timeline and I know turning my IRB, collect the data, analyze it. I'm okay with that part of it. But the cultural bit of it, there's no timetable for that. How did you get that piece done in such a way that by the time you're done, you're Fulbright, you look back and be like, I'm proud of myself? What kind of words of wisdom can you give to an anxious Fulbrighter like me that just got in started and I feel like time is going and I need to keep doing more stuff culturally?
Yeah, I think you're in the country. Like, there's nothing you do that's going to be in the void, in the vacuum, right? So everything you do, even if you're just watching American Netflix, that's going to have like Korean subtitles. And, and also, okay, so this is something I discovered in Mexico. Netflix has different movies in Mexico than in the US. So I watched all these extra movies that I wasn't able to watch for free in the US. Everything you do is going to be part of your cultural experience. So I don't even think you have to be so picky or intentional about it. Rather than just let things happen, right? Like, your daughter is going to school, like stuff is going to happen at school that you're going to have to interact with other parents, or like, see the difference between the education systems. You're going to go to a grocery store and see the difference in the food products,
right,
and the quality of produce and the types of vegetables that you might like never seen before. All you need to do is just walk out of your apartment, like, to really have that cultural experience. I think for me, it was a little bit different because I did have Mexican friends before I moved to Tijuana, who were pretty long-term friends. So I went to their wedding before the Fulbright. And so they sort of included me in their family. So I had that extended Mexican family. But very organically, my daughter just started playing with our next door neighbor's son, who's 9, and she was 6 at a time. So there's an age gap, but they acted almost like older brother, younger sister. She asked me after 2 months if she could call him brother.
Aww.
And it was just like totally unplanned and very cute. And then I went to their house, you know, I invited them over for dinner. They invited me over for dinner. We took the boy out a couple of times to the beach, because there's also some family issues in their household. So I kind of, you know, played a little bit of babysitter for the boy as well. And they did so for my daughter. So, yeah, I think that happened. And then my collaborator, the Fulbright collaborator, very much included me. So I was teaching an undergrad course on introduction to community psychology. So I had like a group of 16 students who I mentored and chatted with in depth. And then the colleague who was co-leading the course became good friends with. And they're just like a lot of random things. Like I would go to the flea market and then chat with people at the flea market then get to know, oh, I need to try this store that's like 20 minutes away. And like went to the plant nursery and did my first like biomagnetism therapy session. I love thrift shopping. So I found some thrift shops and I started chatting with the shop owner. You know, they're just like a lot of random things that happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And all you need to do is just to let it happen.
Yeah, let it happen. Don't force it.
Not rush to the next thing. I mean, I think, like you said, there is a deadline. There's always like IRB and other research things. But just trust that you're going to get it done. Like, you've been a scientist for a while. Like, you know how to do this. And this is how I see it. Like, I think my research project was an excuse for me to be in Mexico rather than, you know,
the
way would be like, I'm there to do the research project, right? This is the goal of my Fulbright. No, I sort of just saw it as like, this is what I'm bringing to the table, so I don't feel like I'm just taking things for free and not contributing, right? Like, I'm bringing my research experience, I'm bringing funding, I am helping out at the nonprofit. I eventually became director of the nonprofit.
Wow, congrats.
Thank you. And then, you know, I'm offering my free teaching for this local university for the semester. That saved them some money and faculty effort. But that's my like contribution. I'm just there to have fun.
Yes, to have fun. Thanks for that. And I feel like I'm just so extra about things. You know, that's just who I am. I started a YouTube vlog just to talk about, you know, some of the mismatch and the matches between what I expected career to be and what it's like. I'm also homeschooling my daughter, but she's also going to a private school here, a private hagwon where they do all kinds of stuff. Like, she's learning Korean language, she's doing violin, skating, golfing, and all that kind of stuff. And then also the cultural exploration. I think just even that enough is enough to just show that. Because I know as a Fulbrighter, you serve as a representative of the American people. And I think just even being here and the things, even doing this podcast, is still paying homage to my time here. So thanks for that reminder to just let it be and not put too much pressure on myself.
I think, you know, one thing we can all learn from children is to go back to that playfulness. I think as adults, we sometimes forget we also need to be playful.
We
need to do things for no other purpose but just to explore what happens when you put these pieces together. And to be creative is super fulfilling. Like not having an agenda, not having a box to check is sometimes the best way to utilize
your life. Thank you. Okay. As a round off, we have talked a lot about so many things, and I feel like for you, we can just keep talking. which is good.
I'm sure other people say the same about you.
Which is why I have a bike and a podcast. I've never stopped talking. If you think about it, I used to get into trouble a lot as a child. Like, my report card in school would be like, she's brilliant, but she talks too much. She asks too much questions. Guess who's laughing now, teachers?
Yeah, right? Send this podcast to your teacher.
Oh, yeah. Like, see, I'm making it work. I'm on a global stage now. Okay, looking back at your journey so far, right? What would you say has been the most rewarding moment in your life or even your career, and why?
That's a very difficult question. Yeah, I think there are many moments that I felt that I forgot that I was doing something on purpose. Like, again, you know, back to that feeling of I forgot that I was working and I'm just connecting to people and offering a pair of listening ears and offering my full attention. I think those moments are generally very, very rewarding. And it could happen on any given day, whether it is speaking in Spanish to a farm worker whose kid is sick here in San Francisco and they have no idea how to navigate the medical system, or it is in Tijuana in the refugee camp talking to a mom, single mom usually, with two children, who's just completely overwhelmed, but at the same time inspires me so much with their strength and their capacity to bring the whole family to the border with no other certainty but this fighting chance to have a better life for her children. Whether it is like after seeing 80 something patients in Haiti because my colleagues decided they wanted to get some training that day, and I was just the only doctor on the pediatric ward and completely exhausted, but also, you know, breaking my personal record of how many patients can I see in one day without collapsing. Coming out of the hospital and hearing a group of women like singing in the dark some religious song that I don't even understand, and feeling like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah,
that is very, very rewarding, and that happens on a regular basis. And I think our job is to notice it when it happens and to be appreciative. Or just waking up my daughter in the morning. That's super important too. Seeing that she's waking up, she's alive, she's growing and beautiful, and she's innocent and worth protecting.
That is so good. And you're raising a global citizen that to have that opportunity and I'll call it the opportunities, right? To be able to bridge theory with practice and be in those lived communities. And also the cultural, you know, shifts, you know, like moving from Chinese, American, Spanish. Mm-hmm. At just 7, she's in for a treat. And that is so, so refreshing to hear and see. So thanks for sharing all of that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's been great chatting with you. Yeah, I do feel like we could explore.
I know.
Good luck with your whole bite and your podcast. I think it's a very unique podcast. And I'm very interested in listening to more of your episodes.
Thank you so much. And this has just been a wonderful time with Dr. Shi on the podcast. So our listeners, we heard so much about her early memories in Shanghai, so her family's moved to Spain, and then her journey through medicine and global health. And I feel like for me, I took so many from this episode, you know, despite how she grew up, just having that compassion that grew out of displacement and that belonging is something that we can create wherever we go. I loved how she talked about finding purpose, her mindset, and how that has guided her through every border, every classroom interaction, and even every clinical interactions. She's also talked a lot about her support to immigrant families, and not just, you know, talking the talk, but she's walked the walk literally across borders, and how she's teaching mindfulness to children. I remember just her talk on healing begins with listening to ourselves and to one another. Now, to learn more about her work in global pediatrics, mental health, and mindfulness, I'll put in some of her website page on the link, so you can, you know, go learn more about her work. I just want to say thank you so much, Dr. Shi, for joining us today on, you know, on the podcast, and just some of the many ways you have left so many gems for us to take home with. This has been a wonderful, wonderful time on the podcast with you.
Thank you.
And shout out to Dr. Akande. I forgot to do that at the beginning. Dr. Tux Akande for recommending Dr. Shi. She's like, you need to talk to one of my friends. You'll love her. And I'm like, okay, yeah, please. I believe you. Just who is the person? So thanks to him for recommending you to us. This has been great. And I'll bring you back. I'll let you know in what capacity, but I know you'll definitely be back on the podcast.
Okay.
Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.